And there is a bit of an issue at the moment with we need more of these staff from overseas too, with the staff shortage. But
well, that's going to parlay into our next segment. We're going to get Matty Holland, who's the Victorian jockey boss, on in a moment. But Lizzie, you've probably been watching on the social media feedback from the new Racing Australia rule, which it's a pretty strongly worded rule, which says basically outside information from form analysts and those that develop speed maps is not allowed to occur. That's how it reads, and there has been a lot of fallout from that. But I think when we get Matt on, he'll tell us that it's okay to actually still get those instructions. However, they can't overarch what a trainer or an owner will tell a jockey. How have you seen the release and the interpretation of this new rule?
Well, initially I saw the release, and then I had a lot of the jockeys at Rosehill come and have a chat with me about it as well, and then a few form analysts who I know help jockeys, and the interpretation has definitely not been how it's been that, you know, they can't talk anymore. Mm. And it's a rule that I thought initially, I mean, I hope there will be some clearing up, because I don't actually know how it could possibly be policed. And I think it's wrong that they expect jockeys not to be able to speak to outside sources to further, you know, their knowledge about a race. Everyone needs someone to talk to, and confidence is something that is really important with these jockeys. So hopefully Matt can clear up exactly what this rule means. But the interpretation I know from a number of jockeys here in Sydney, and also form analysts as well who help jockeys, is that they aren't allowed to continue their association together.
Well, Matt Holland joins us on the line now. Matt, appreciate your time. Has this been a poorly worded, constructed rule that's been put out by Racing Australia? Because most people believe now that it is off limits to speak to a form analyst or someone who helps with speed maps.
Well, that's not my understanding, Michael. My understanding is that that riders are able to engage with, you know, whoever they like as far as collecting as much information as they require and as they've been doing. I think the key word in this ruling is instructions. And once you separate instructions from, you know, advice or information or speed maps, it's pretty clear that instructions have always landed with the connections. They've always had pretty much final say. Now, whether that's in conjunction with form analysts or you know, people who provide speed maps, and usually that is the case. This most trainers, jockeys, and even connections for that matter, are armed with as much information as they possibly can. And I think that the rule has been brought into play to just avoid any confusion on who ultimately has the final say on how they'd like their horses ridden, in, you know, as per the instructions. And I think that's the key word. Once you get your head around that, certainly from our point of view, that was the way we understood it. And if there was any, you know, a differing view on it, we wouldn't support it if that was the case. So that's as I understand it.
It's interesting, Matty, isn't it, the era of the, you know, this term that was always just loosely in the back of our heads about, you know, reading races and so on, but the speed map, and what is it, and who creates it, and how important is it, and so on. And to me, it's come out of this era of increasing amount of racing, and jockeys are increasingly time poor, and the need to be competitive, and the need to have outside third parties assist them, because they simply don't have the time to do a lot of the work themselves. And that has led us to the speed map, and the stewards have their own speed map interpretation, and so do a lot of form analysts, and some of the jockeys like Jamie Carr and Damien Lane more have it as a loose thing in their head. But it is an unusual era we're in, where we are sort of almost dependent on the speed map, but everyone seems to have their own version of it.
Yes. What I would say is that what you will find is most jockeys will come out to ride in a race, and you know, the expectation is that they're going to go out and have an understanding of what has pace, what's going to go forward, what's going to go back, and that a lot of the time is determined by barriers. But there's an element of feel too, and there are a lot of jockeys that go out there and ride on feel, and you know, because let's be honest, it's only a guideline. Speed maps, and you know, if you went out there and your expectation is that you know, the horse that's drawn outside you is going to go forward, and you're not privy to what the connections want to do with that horse, and they may elect to go back on that horse. So if you're sitting there waiting to for that horse to go forward and follow that horse, where does your, you've got to throw your speed map out the window pretty quickly. I think the important thing to, and my view is that this has been a complete overreaction to what the rule is. The rule states that the final instructions land with the connections of the horse. And I think once you get your head around that, as far as all the other information that's out there, you know, jockeys are able to access that information and, you know, use it to for whatever advantage they want. But when it comes down to the instructions, that's a separate issue. And what we can't have is we can't have form analysts and speed map providers providing multiple maps to multiple jockeys and then providing instructions to those jockeys. So once you get your head around the difference of the wording, I think it's pretty clear-cut for me.
Matt Hyland, the Victorian Jockeys boss, is with us with Matty Stewart and also Lizzie Jelfs. Matt Stewart broke this story earlier in the week, Matt, and that was the irregularities from out-of-competition testing at the Ballarat Training Centre. In the end, jockey Sam Payne's been given a six-month suspension for testing positive to a banned substance, and two track riders have also been suspended from riding track work for 6 weeks. Matt, the situation there individually obviously is disappointing, but is there a wider issue in regards to, I suppose, it's not just racing, but society in general, but the pressures on track work riders and jockeys and trying to have them working grueling hours and so forth. Is this the tipping point for something that could be a bigger issue?
Michael, I think that, the recreational drug issue is, as you point out, is a society issue, and it would be unrealistic to think that it wouldn't affect or be in our industry in some capacity. But what it does do, you know, what we can't have is people under the influence of substances and then out there riding in what is already a pretty risky occupation, you know, whether it's track riding or as jockeys or stable staff or whoever that's working with horses. They're unpredictable animals. So we certainly can't condone that sort of, we can't make any allowances for that, that's for sure. But, you know, I think it's a difficult one, Michael, the track work rider situation. I mean, it's a very sparse workforce, and that's going to be already under a fair bit of pressure, and it's going to create more pressure on that workforce. And, you know, where do we start with that? You know, it feels like we need to have a summit of some sort and have a really broad discussion about how we make the job, you know, of stable hands, track riders more appealing, because clearly, you know, I know for sure they're not queuing up. You know, there's not 400 people queued up outside of Racing Victoria looking to be track riders, you know, so it's a big industry issue that certainly needs discussing.
That summit actually will occur, Matty, between the 22nd and the 23rd of April. PRAs, over 100 industry participants are going to be involved. PRAs, trainers, representatives and so on, to try and thresh out this very, very complicated issue. And it got exacerbated by the changing of the 457 to the 407 visas with restricted access to the country from skilled workers, and then COVID hit as well. So those things exacerbated a problem that I think was probably already there with the attractiveness of these jobs to racing. And Andrew Nicol told me this morning that we're probably 200 track riders short around Australia and probably 65 or 70 short in Victoria. So whether we need an academy of some description, or whether we need to try and convince the government to loosen up the travel post-COVID, the travel arrangements for overseas workers, and there are a lot of them banging on the door that are able to fill the void, but because of the 457 situation first, they were unable to come. So there are some ideas floating around, and I guess the interesting thing is that they will have that summit, but we've had these things before, haven't we? It's all about what comes out of it, not the idea that it's actually that it's occurring. It's more about what comes out of it.
Well, an interesting thing, Matt, you know, Lindsay Parker recently, I'm a very good friends with Matt Pumper, and he's recently been employed by Lindsay Park to create a training and upskilling program internally at Lindsay Park at Euroa, which, you know, they've been running for the last couple of months, I think it is now, and they're churning out their own existing staff upskilling them so that they're able to ride track work as well. So there was, I went up there, you know, a month or so ago, and there was half a dozen girls and guys that were part of this program. So when they finished work in the morning, they were going out there using their facilities, trained by Matt Pumper, to upskill them to be able to ride track work, because track works are really, not anyone can ride track work. People can ride ponies or ride at an equestrian level, but that doesn't necessarily mean you can ride a thoroughbred in track work. And it requires a lot of expertise and a lot of training. And that, I take my hat off to them and Matt, what he's doing there. And it's a template that should be, you know, replicated probably by, you know, the state jurisdictions. And I think if you look at the British Racing School, Lizzie would probably confirm this. And, you know, the British Racing School doesn't just churn out apprentices. It churns out stable and track staff. And people start from the very beginning of the training, and they spend probably up to about 3 months working in a stable with retired racehorses. And it replicates what it is to work in a racing stable. And I think the time has come where this is not just a state issue, this is a national issue, and it's even a global issue. You know, there's issues overseas. And one of the biggest problems is we've got to make the job more appealing. And you know, we've got the issues with the starting times here in Australia and what time people are starting. And we've got all these, you know, low, medium, large businesses that have all, you know, they want more staff, they need more staff, but they're not prepared to change their business model to suit that problem. So you've got a really big issue there, you know. So it becomes personal interest. So you know, it's going to take a really a lot of leadership to get some change in that space. I'm sure of that.
Yeah, the British Racing School model definitely works, but it's not just about encouraging people into racing. It's exactly what Matt said. It's keeping them in the game. The attrition rate is just incredible. I mean, the hours get on top of people.
You've lived it, Lizzie.
Yeah, and even myself, I didn't know what I was going to do when I had my family. Was I going to stay in racing? Can I have the children and still work in racing? And I think that's what made it's so difficult, because I didn't know where to go to next. And unfortunately for me, there was an opportunity for me in the media, but that doesn't happen to everyone. I mean, we've lost a wonderful stalwart of the industry, Tanya Rouse, who worked for Gay Waterhouse. She had 10 years of plus experience before she started working for Gay. She worked for Gay for 15 plus years. She then ended up with Hawkses doing the same role as an assistant or a professional foreman. And then now the hours have just got too much for her. Now she's out of the industry. We've lost her completely. And I know we are going to lose people like that in the industry, but we don't want to. We take so long to educate them and upskill them and have them, you know, at the top of their game throughout this process, that we have nowhere for them to go at the end of it. So I think the attrition rate is one of the biggest factors of racing, and the hours are definitely, and the conditions are what is important that we address.
And Maddie, the other thing with this too is who takes ownership of the issue? I mean, Racing Victoria wants to be more of a regulator and doesn't want to get overly involved in the idea of an academy and all the issues that would land on their shoulders, insurances and all that sort of stuff. And Racing Australia, well, who knows what their role really is anyway. But the issue is, if it is a very, very big issue to be dealt with, who starts to deal with it first and who takes ownership?
Yeah, I think that's a key point, Matt, but I think the time has come. What we can see is when there's discussions, it's certainly at trainers level up, and a trainer in another lifetime, and I certainly understand the difficulties of having stable staff and keeping stable staff given the hours that you need them to work. And we've got a real problem there, don't we, with, you know, some 800 trainers in Victoria. So imagine what it is nationally. And, you know, when push comes to shove, it's the same old situation where you're surveying the audience and you're getting a 50-50 response on either side of the fence. So if you don't have any change, the problem won't go away. You need to, someone needs, whoever it is responsible for that, to step up and, you know, make the change. And or certainly discuss about which is what is the way forward? You know, it's a very, very complex issue. And, you know, because I can understand people don't want, you know, they don't want to be told how to run their business model. But you can't whinge and moan about the lack of staff, but then not be prepared to make some kind of change to attract more or make the job more appealing so that you can attract a new generation of people.
Matt, appreciate your time this morning. It's an issue which will create a lot of discussion within the industry, but I appreciate you having a chat this morning.
Good on you. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.